Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's day two for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. In the face of intense questioning about past rulings and past speeches with phrases like wise Latina, she joked with senators about who loves baseball more and then borrowed a Republican metaphor for judging.
I prefer to describe what judges do like umpires, is to be impartial and bring an open mind to every case before them. And by an open mind, I mean a judge who looks at the facts of each case, listens and understands the arguments of the parties, and applies the law as the law commands. It's a refrain I keep repeating because that is my philosophy of judging. Applying the law.
In this, the second day of her confirmation hearing, Sotomayor also stated that the Supreme Court's decision to legalize abortion in Roe versus Wade was settled precedent. And she said that, quote, some good came out of the Supreme Court's involvement in the Bush versus Gore presidential election because election systems were improved. Christina Moore is editor at SCOTUSblog.com. She's been blogging live from the hearing room. First of all, Christina, how is your sense of how Judge Sotomayor is faring?
I think she's doing very well so far. Her demeanor has been very consistent throughout the morning. She's spoken deliberately and clearly. Her temper hasn't been raised at all. She, in fact, addressed very early on earlier accusations of her having a temper or being discourteous.
What did she say?
Oh, she didn't actually speak about the accusations, but in reference to a question about cameras in the court that came from Senator Hatch, I believe, she kind of jokingly made an aside about how she's always collegial on the bench, which for anyone who's sort of followed the criticisms of her is pretty clearly addressing those earlier accusations.
Right. Well, let's get to some of the most contentious issues. Ranking Republican on the Judiciary Committee, Jeff Sessions, pressed Sotomayor on her ruling in Ricci versus DiStefano. This is when Sotomayor's appeals court panel sided with the city of New Haven in their decision to throw out a promotions test on which white firefighters like Frank Ricci did well, minorities did not. Sotomayor's appeals panel decision was recently overturned by the Supreme Court. Senator Sessions said her panel decision was cursory and didn't address important constitutional questions. Here's more of what he said and some of her response.
Do you think that Frank Ricci and the other firefighters whose claims you dismissed felt that their arguments and concerns were appropriately understood and acknowledged by such a short opinion from the court?
We were very sympathetic and expressed our sympathy to the firefighters who challenged the city's decision, Mr. Ricci and the others. We understood the efforts that they had made in taking the test. We said as much.
Well, and she also went on to say that in the end, it was precedent that ruled her decision, and that's what the Supreme Court says. She's repeatedly referred to precedent. Christina, what is she saying by talking about what previous courts have ruled?
Well, she's talking very specifically about the Second Circuit and the precedent that they had there. And what she's gone on to say is that very clearly the Supreme Court has applied a sort of new standard about disparate impact testing, and that it was a matter of first impression before the Supreme Court, and that as an appellate judge, it was her job to follow the Second Circuit's precedent.
Yeah. Well, Session pressed her on what he said were numerous speeches over a decade, including one in which she said she hoped a wise Latina would reach a better conclusion in a case than a white male. Of course, we're all very familiar with that, that some say came out of context, but let's listen to what Session said.
Judge, I think it's consistent in the comments I've quoted to you and your previous statements that you do believe that your backgrounds will affect the result in cases, and that's troubling me. So that is not impartiality. Don't you think that is not consistent with your statement? That you believe your role as a judge is to serve the larger interest of impartial justice?
No, sir. As I've indicated, my record shows that at no point or time have I ever permitted my personal views or sympathies to influence an outcome of a case.
Well, did she go into detail in cases where her personal feelings might not have been the outcome. For instance, we know she ruled for the Bush administration and against abortion rights advocates who wanted to overturn federal rules restricting aid to countries that provide abortions. Did she go into any of those cases?
She has not at all. They haven't really discussed her record except for Ricci Maloney, which is a Second Amendment case about nunchucks.
Nunchucks. These are the some call them weapons. They are used in martial arts. They're the two pieces of wood that are tied that attach by strings, and they've been banned.
Right. And so that's actually been a big point of contention now, just in the last round of questioning with Senator Hatch. But really, they've only discussed Ricci, and they have not talked about, you know, a specific incident in which her personal sympathies were contrary to her ruling. She has, however, made abundantly clear what her judicial philosophy is, and that in saying that, well, first of all, that she was just making a rhetorical flourish and actually sort of riffing off of an earlier speech by former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who had talked about, you know, as a woman, I bring certain things to the bench, but I rule as a judge, not as a woman.
And in fact, O'Connor said a wise man and a wise woman would reach the same conclusion. And Sotomayor, as she said, was riffing on that to a group of, I believe, young Latinos. And she also said that her words fell flat. She recognized that. But we mentioned the nunchucks. Just very briefly, we have a few seconds. What did she say about gun rights?
She's very specifically talked about Justice Scalia's opinion in D.C. versus Heller, the D.C. guns case, and referred to on multiple occasions footnote 23, which references how it's not clear yet. It hasn't yet been decided whether the Second Amendment is incorporated in the states.
But she did go on to say that she recognized the importance of gun rights to many, and she has godchildren who are NRA members.
She has said that, and she kind of used the typical line of some of my friends are hunters. So she, I think, does recognize the significance of the Second Amendment to American people, but they have yet to make a Supreme Court ruling that holds that the Second Amendment is, in fact, incorporated against the states.
Christina Moore. We've got to go for time, but we'll continue to look at this hearing through the week. Christina Moore, editor at SCOTUSblog.com, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, today the House of Representatives is expected to introduce sweeping health care reform legislation that would tax the wealthy and require all Americans to buy affordable health care insurance. The price tag isn't known. The president is pushing the Senate to get its version of the bill moving, so he'll have a bill to sign by the end of the month. Well, Harvard Business School's Michael Porter has his own prescription for America's health care system. In short, he says universal coverage is just the beginning. He wants to restructure how health care is delivered so insurers and doctors are great and paid based on how healthy their patients are. Porter is widely known for his five forces analysis, which business leaders use to decide whether or not to venture into a new market. He recently had an article on healthcare reform in the New England Journal of Medicine, and we welcome Michael Porter.
Thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Let's get to a word that you use a lot. You call for more value for the patient. What does it mean in that context, value?
Well, Robin, we believe that one of the big problems with healthcare is that we haven't thought about it in the way that actually fundamentally matters to our society. What we really care about in healthcare is to get good health outcomes for every dollar we spend, and that's value. Value is the quality you achieve for the cost you're spending. And it seems incredible, but there's really very little in our healthcare system or how we compete to provide healthcare or pay for healthcare that relates to actual value for the patients. We've got a system that's all cobbled up.
Well, I need to know more about what you mean by that, you know, how well patients do, because you also say, as I said, insurers should only prosper if their subscribers' health improves. But doesn't that drive insurers to only insure healthy people?
First of all, we've got to get everybody covered. I think that's well understood from an equity point of view. But what is less understood is that if everybody isn't covered, we actually can't be efficient. We can't deliver value because people need to get preventative care. They need to get screened. They need to be able to go to the doctor before something gets serious. And so we've got to move to universal insurance, not only for equity, but also for efficiency and for value and to deliver good health. And so one of the critical things in achieving universal insurance is not just to get everybody covered, but to change the nature of competition in the insurance industry. Insurance companies have succeeded by excluding sick people, by beating up on the doctors and forcing down their reimbursement so they don't have time to spend with their patients. That's a competition that actually destroys value for the patient.
Well, so you say there has to be universal care, in part so everyone gets preventative care, not just the more expensive critical care. Critics of health care reform worry that the current plan from the Obama administration, which calls for a public plan to compete with private insurance, will mean that employers will stop offering health care. But a recent study shows that here in Massachusetts, where health care is mandated, the opposite has happened. More employees are insured. Yes, some employers are fined if they don't offer coverage. But because workers are required to be insured, they're pushing their employers to cover them. So that would seem to back up your thinking.
Well, exactly. Employers have a vested interest in the health of their employees. They want their employees to be at work. They don't want to have lost days. They don't want to have what's called presenteeism, where an employee is at work, but they're not very productive because they're worried or they're not feeling well. I want your listeners to really understand that employers are good guys here. They want their employees to be healthy.
Right.
But if an employer doesn't provide coverage and his or her employees end up requiring public assistance, then we ought to tax that employer. That employer is free riding on the system. Once we have a good insurance option for everybody, we have to mandate coverage like we have here in Massachusetts, because the people that don't have insurance, some of them are poor, but many of them actually are just young and healthy.
Okay, hold on a second, because you know, during his campaign, Barack Obama opposed that idea.
Right.
So how do you get that on a national level?
Well, first of all the other major groups don't oppose it. So, you know, the Senate Finance Committee, you know, Senator Kennedy's committee. And I think President Obama was trying to be, you know, kind of, you know, cautious. But I think he would certainly support an individual mandate today as we speak, given the way the national debate has evolved.
I want to move to some of the quality and value issues that you talked
about. Oh, thank goodness.
Yes.
Because we, in this country, we are overrun with discussions about insurance and coverage. And, of course, my article suggests that that's actually not the most important issue.
Well, as you said, it's how healthcare providers are judged. And there should be more of a sense of the overall health of a patient, not just how well a physician does on an individual procedure. So what are you talking about? What kind of measure?
Well, there's an equation. It's the health outcomes per dollar spent. It's more than just did you survive. It's how close did you get to recovering your health. And then there's questions like, how long did it take? How ugly was the care process? How many complications and side effects and discomfort did you have to experience? Finally, a critical issue in outcomes is, how sustainable was the recovery? Mm-hmm. Were you able to sustain your health, or did you just have a relapse in 3 months or 6 months or 12 months? The only way that you can fundamentally improve the value of any service or any product over time is you've got to actually measure the value. And so we have to step to the plate and measure outcomes.
And new measurement might mean that we discover we're spending a huge amount of money at the end of life rather than in prevention, but also that rather than knowing how many times scissors are left in after surgery, we may know, are those surgeries effective? So how do you measure outcomes in healthcare? Look to the world of transplants, according to Harvard business professor Michael Porter. We'll do that when we come back. Also, later today, the trial of the ex-president of Liberia begins today. Will he reveal how he escaped a Massachusetts prison 20 years ago? That's later. Back after a quick break, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
We're back with Harvard Business School professor Michael Porter and his ideas for reforming the U.S. healthcare system. Michael, before the break, you were saying that we have to change the way we measure outcomes, basically track how healthy a person is over time. That sounds like a massive undertaking. Is it really feasible?
This is not a pipe dream. We can do this. We've already done it. They're doing it in Sweden. They're doing it in a bunch of other countries. So let's take organ transplantation.
Mm-hmm.
Every single organ transplantation that occurs in America, the outcomes are measured rigorously. I can tell you for every hospital, for every kind of organ, how well they do, what the survival rate is, the rejection rate, the complication rate. Every provider has a scorecard. They see how well they do. They see where their weak spots are. And you know what happened? What happened is that all of those things improved dramatically over the last 10 or 15 years. And every patient now knows exactly how well this hospital does in liver transplants versus that hospital. And so we're getting patients moving to the really excellent providers. This is what we've got to create in healthcare. We've got to create the data and the results measurements which allow us to actually make good decisions and which motivate and inform the provider community to actually improve. Right now, for a doctor to want to improve their care, they only do it because of professional pride. They don't have any information. They don't have any benchmarks. And we simply have to change that.
Well, and Americans have been stunned recently to realize that this isn't already happening. For instance, I'm thinking of when Senator Ted Kennedy discovered his brain tumor, and a certain treatment was recommended here in the New England area, and then there was another treatment available at Duke University that many didn't know about. And mm-hmm. so that kind of exchange of information.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, Robin, we don't even know how many patients a given team has cared for with a particular problem. So we don't even know which hospitals have dealt with the most brain cancers.
Well, but you know, there's been criticism of this idea. This also goes towards electronic records. Mm-hmm. And there's been criticism that it just creates more layers of bureaucracy. You recommend more organizations, possibly three new organizations, to oversee healthcare. And that sounds like more bureaucracy. And doctors are already saying paperwork, one of the greatest inefficiencies in the system.
Let's distinguish between today's paperwork and the kind of paperwork I'm talking about. By the way, the organizations that I recommended, Robin, we need one organization to coordinate this outcome measurement process. We need an organization to sort out electronic medical records, in particular the standards, so that all the systems can talk to each other. So we need that organization. And we need another organization probably to sort out reimbursement. This is a topic we haven't talked about. Right now, healthcare providers get paid per service provided. So, if you do a surgery, you get paid for the surgery. If you do a more complicated surgery, you get paid more. That obviously system drives up costs. It's obvious. We need to move from that payment system to what we call a bundled system, where you don't get paid for the individual services, you get paid for the whole care cycle. So if you're a diabetic, you pay the provider to care for that diabetic and do whatever is necessary to manage that person effectively over the course of 6 months or a year.
Is it a flat rate? In other words, someone determines in one part of the country it costs $3,000 for insulin over a year, and another part it costs $2,000. Here's what you get.
Yeah, these would be really a total package price. You know, when we buy a car, we don't buy the tires and the engine separately. You know, we buy the whole car. So we've got to change the reimbursement model. But today's paperwork, Robin, is really paperwork that's caused by the current inefficient structure of the system. So, for example, if you have cancer, you have to see an oncologist, you have to see a radiation therapist, you have to have pathology work done, you have to go deal with a lot of different specialists. Every one of those specialists is a separate appointment. It's a separate bill that has to be settled. And so the paperwork really comes from this fragmented structure that we have today, where we're paying every individual provider little piecework amounts for the little bit of the care process that they engage in. We need to move to much more integrated care structures, where we go to a team and they take care of our problem.
Let's ask you about that, because this integrated model, several health care providers all together.
Right.
Do you mean, by the way, in one setting?
In one setting.
Okay. Well, what about in rural areas, first of all?
It's a very good question. In rural areas, what's happening now is the rural hospitals are just trying to do too much. They don't have the volume to have a dedicated team to provide integrated care. They don't see enough cases. They don't have enough experience. So what we've got to get rural hospitals to do is rural hospitals have to really be feeder hospitals. If you've got head and neck cancer, you shouldn't be treated in a rural hospital. You should be supervised by an expert, you know, that sees enough cases. Now, the rural hospital can have a relationship with that regional center and provide follow-up care and provide ongoing monitoring and so forth. But right now, every healthcare organization tends to see itself as a standalone organization that tries to do too much.
Well, one of the potential problems with your integrated model, all these doctors working together, was addressed by the Stark Laws, which were designed to prevent doctors from becoming too chummy, essentially, and mm-hmm. sort of getting kickbacks from sending patients back and forth. But
yep.
that would not be a problem in your integrated model, Because you've suggested bundled reimbursement, right?
So bundled reimbursement and measuring outcomes.
Right. So they would. There's a pool of money that they'd have to be working with, assigned by the insurer.
Right. And if one of their colleagues isn't doing a good job, the last thing they want to do is refer anybody to that colleague.
Because
they want measured. They want to self-police themselves to kind of improve. And in fact, I do want to say that what disturbs me about the current healthcare discussion going on in Washington is that it's quite a good discussion on insurance now. But it's a very simplistic discussion on delivery. And yet, ultimately, delivery is what's more important and what's going to move the needle much, much more in the long run. So my concern and my passion is to try to get us focusing on, you know, how do we actually transform delivery to improve value? That is the fundamental issue that this country has to address.
Harvard Business School's Michael Porter. He's also author of the book Redefining Healthcare, ticking through the ways he thinks, if he ruled the world, the healthcare world, it should look. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, 4 out of 5 people on Earth today were not alive when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon 40 years ago. Will those people back plans to send humans back there now? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the saxophone sounds of Grace Kelly. After the news, Here and Now. Will Facebook knock Google off its throne? Google dominates the internet with 65% of the search market and $16 billion in revenues, about 60 times the sales of Facebook. But Facebook has something Google doesn't, information about Facebook's 200 million users, who every month post 4 billion bits of information that's valuable to advertisers. And Facebook hopes to make it more valuable by creating a new search engine to rival Google's. Fred Vogelstein is with Wired Magazine. Fred, under Facebook's plan, I understand if I'm trying to find information about, say, a new movie, I can search my friends' Facebook pages. But I'm thinking, what if I don't care what my friends think? What if I prefer a film scholar's review? Tell me how this works for me.
Eventually, our friend networks will enable us to do all sorts of things that you can do on Google. Facebook has not yet released this Facebook search, which is in effect going to allow you to search not only your friend network, but everything inside of Facebook to try to find what you're looking for. And with 200 million or so people on Facebook, it's arguably true that you could probably find the scholar just as easily, if not more easily.
Right, because what you'll find on Facebook are the various links that Facebook users have posted. So you will go to all those side roads. But isn't it the question of who owns the information on Facebook? Facebook users have objected in the past to Facebook claiming ownership of information on their site. How are they going to feel about being part of a search engine that's making money for Facebook? In essence, they're creating the search engine for Facebook.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's the way the internet works right now. And some people are comfortable with it and some people aren't. One of the ways that Google works is that it takes your data, uses that to kind of make its service a little better. Facebook undoubtedly will do exactly the same thing. So, for example, Google takes your email messages from Gmail and uses that to generate content lists. And I think Facebook is going to do exactly the same thing. One of the things that I think people have not thought through that carefully, though, is that what Facebook does offer people, which I think they haven't really thought through on their own, is the kind of control over who sees what that you really don't get with Google. So, for example, I can look at my friend lists on Facebook and decide who's going to have access to what information. And I think that kind of control is going to make people feel okay about sharing the vast amounts of information that they have. And Facebook gives me the control to do that in a way that Google does not.
Well, if Facebook is able to become not just the social networking site that it is, but the search engine that it wants to be, and does dethrone Google, I mean, just give us, what does that mean? How does that change the internet?
Well, one of the things that people don't spend a lot of time thinking about when it comes to Google is how it makes money. So everybody thinks of Google as a search engine, and they think of Google as an email provider and as a place to maybe store some photographs or to do some maps. But Google is an advertising company. Google makes money by presenting contextual advertising next to its search results. Google is the largest source of traffic on the internet. If Facebook can become a source of traffic to rival Google's, that's going to make a very big dent in Google's power and how much control it has over how the internet evolves.
Which means that if Google actually gets slayed by Facebook, those users who aren't yet Facebook users might be forced to be.
I think you're already starting to see that. Facebook has more than 200 million users. That's starting to acquire the kind of network effects that spurred the growth of Microsoft. A generation ago, people started using Windows because everybody else was using Windows. And then everybody started using Microsoft Word because everybody else was using Microsoft Word and Excel. And I think people are starting to use Facebook for exactly the same reason.
That's Fred Vogelstein. He's contributing editor for Wired Magazine, speaking to us about Facebook's ambitious plans to create a search engine to rival Google. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, and if you have thoughts on this or any story, go to our site, hereandnow.org. We're also looking for world domination. You can contact us there by clicking on Contact Us or just leave a comment right there on the homepage. We'll be back in 30 seconds with the war crimes trial of Charles Taylor, Here and Now. Former Liberian President Charles Taylor took the stand at his war crimes trial today and said the case against him is based on lies and misinformation.
I am a father of 14 children with love for humanity, have fought all my life to do what I thought was right in the interest of justice and fair play.
Taylor is charged with crimes against humanity, including the use of child soldiers to terrorize neighboring Sierra Leone while he was president. He was born in Liberia, but graduated from Bentley College here in Boston, and as we'll hear, had a storied chapter of his life here before making his way back to Africa. The BBC's Adam Minot is covering Taylor's trial at The Hague. Adam, how would you characterize Taylor's demeanor?
Well, I thought it was a very assured performance. He didn't seem to miss a trick. He seemed to have very good recall of dates and information. So based on his performance alone, I think he must have been pleased with what happened today.
Well, remind us of the charges against them, many having to do with the civil war in Liberia's neighbor, Sierra Leone.
That's right. Well, they all really center on what happened in Sierra Leone. Really, we've had a catalogue of the most appalling atrocities, and people have paraded through the witness box, some bearing horrible scars and wounds, some without limbs, perpetrated by the rebel movement in Sierra Leone while the rebellion was going on there.
Well, in fact, here's some sound from a man who says he was one of the victims of that civil war. His name is Mambu Jabati. He's one of an estimated 500,000 people either killed or mutilated during the war. Let's listen.
I lost my right hand in 1999. I was 15 years old. Rebels from the Revolutionary United Front surrounded our house, and they just chopped my right arms off, just like that.
Adam Minot, that's the charge, that the rebels would use these machetes to hack off limbs. But what are the direct charges against Charles Taylor?
The charge specifically is that he orchestrated the rebel activity in Sierra Leone. Now, he was the president of Liberia at the time, and his defense is that I was trying to run affairs of state in my own country. How could I possibly have micromanaged a rebellion in a neighboring country? But the prosecution says that he did exactly that with one expressed purpose, and that was to wrest control of the huge diamond wealth. And at one point today, Charles Taylor was asked, did you receive any diamonds? Because the prosecution had said that he was regularly given diamonds, often in mayonnaise jars. He denied that, as indeed he denied every other charge laid against him.
Does the prosecution feel they have the proof, though, when they get the chance to show it?
I think they do. And they say, you know, what their intention is to show that Charles Taylor did indeed mastermind the operation of the rebels with this express purpose of retaining control of the massive diamond wealth in Sierra Leone.
The BBC's World Affairs correspondent Adam Minot speaking to us from The Hague. Adam, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, people here in Massachusetts are watching the Taylor trial, hoping he'll shed some light on a mystery that dates back decades to a young Charles Taylor's escape from the Plymouth County House of Corrections in 1985. Brian Bender is a reporter for the Boston Globe. Brian, Taylor did talk today about his schooling in Massachusetts, but not the escape. Tell us more about his whole Boston connection.
Taylor first arrives in the Boston area way back in 1972 as a college student, spent about a decade in Boston, which is where he got his degree. And then in 1983, he goes back to Liberia, where he gets a post in the government of Samuel Doe, then leader of Liberia. That didn't last very long because he's accused of embezzling money from the Liberian government, and he flees back to Boston. And I think it's in 1984, he's arrested in Somerville, pending extradition back to Liberia. So he's awaiting this extradition trial when he breaks out of prison. There's been lots of conspiracies swirling around that breakout. There were four other individuals that also had escaped with him. They were later caught. He disappears and then shows up, you know, 4 years later as head of a rebel group that overthrows Samuel Doe in Liberia.
Well, let's try to fill in some of the places in between. First of all, he had a pretty storied lawyer in his trial. He was represented by Ramsey Clark.
Exactly. The former U.S. Attorney General was his attorney.
Right. And there are some people who've tried to fill in some of the spaces between the breakout from the prison and resurfacing in Liberia. Why don't you fill us in on some of those? It involved his family?
Yeah, well, the way the story is told, that he somehow coordinated this breakout with his wife, who apparently had picked him up at a predetermined spot not far from the Plymouth prison, was then driven to Staten Island, where then the trail sort of disappears. Some people think he got to Mexico, and that's where he then traveled back to Africa. Others think, you know, there could have been some role by the U.S. government or some agency of the U.S. government to help Charles Taylor get out of prison, get back to Africa. Samuel Doe was not a friend of the United States, the leader of Liberia. Obviously, Charles Taylor was an opponent of his. But it gets more interesting because when Charles Taylor goes back to Africa, he doesn't go to Liberia, he goes to Libya. Of course, at the time, in the mid-1980s, Libya was an enemy of the United States. Muammar Gaddafi, its leader, was accused of supporting terrorism. But Charles Taylor goes to Libya and trains there for several years in guerrilla warfare before he then goes back to Liberia. Again, there's lots of conspiracy theories that there may have been some relationship between Taylor as an informant for the U.S. government.
Well, and so you're saying that there's a chance, there are theories that the U.S. government springs Charles Taylor out of prison only to see him go on to be one of the most ruthless dictators in Africa.
Well, yes. Eventually, there's no doubt Charles Taylor turns out to be not a friend of the United States, but a pretty bad actor, an African strongman who rules at the barrel of a gun. But I think back in 1985, I don't think the U.S. government quite knew exactly who he was or where he was headed.
Brian Bender, do you think we're going to hear anything from Charles Taylor about this? Would it do him any good to say, for instance, that it was the U.S. that actually backed him?
I spoke last week with the prosecutor in the War Crimes Tribunal, Stephen Rapp, and his view was that it's very possible that Charles Taylor will talk about this chapter of his life. There's doubt, however, that he would come out and directly say, yes, the U.S. government helped me break out of prison and helped me get back to Africa, because, quite frankly, doing that would undercut some of the other arguments he has long made, which is that he is this independent African leader who is being victimized by the West, that they don't like independent African leaders. They only like African leaders who do their bidding. However, Mr. Rapp, the prosecutor, does think that it's very possible he will talk about this Boston chapter of his life, including the prison break, perhaps as a way to kind of burnish the cult of personality, if you will. Here's this independent African leader who overthrew a dictator, broke out of prison so that he could go back to his native country and free his people. We'll certainly be watching it closely to see what he says about those years.
A fascinating chapter. Brian Bender of the Boston Globe. Brian, thanks so much.
Sure.
Okay, just this program note for you. Tomorrow on Here and Now, we're going to speak to Elizabeth Warren. She's the woman monitoring government aid to Wall Street, but she's also the person who came up with the idea of a consumer commission. She'll tell us what she thinks consumers need. That's tomorrow, Elizabeth Warren on Here and Now. We'll be back in about 1 minute with a visit with saxophonist Grace Kelly. Here and Now. Welcome back to Here and Now. Saxophonist Grace Kelly has been busy. She finished her first year at the Berklee College of Music, released her fifth CD, Mood Changes. Oh, and did we mention she turned 17 in May? Grace is from Brookline, Massachusetts. When she plays, she exudes delight at being alive and being in the company of some of the country's great musicians, including saxophone great Phil Woods, who gave her a tip of his trademark cap. In fact, he gave her his cap when she played this song, I'll Remember April, with him. Grace plays alto, tenor, and soprano sax. She also composes and sings, as in this song, But Life Goes On.
Are you a fool who thinks I don't know what has happened? Just look around, it seems that we already know.
That's But Life Goes On from Grace Kelly's new CD, Mood Changes. When she was a mere 15 years old, she came to our studios with her saxophone. With the release this year of her new CD, we bring you again our conversation. I was just watching your face as you were listening to yourself, your eyebrows going up and down, you know, all emoting.
Yeah, I'm a tough critic on myself. Just thinking, that sounds interesting, or I wonder what I could have done there, and oh, no, that's nice, you know.
Well, let's get this out of the way first. Your name, Grace Kelly, but not after the actress?
No, you know, this is a really funny story. My birth name was Grace Chung, and then my mom divorced my biological father, and then she married Bob Kelly, and then he adopted my sister and me. The funny thing was, I've always loved old Grace Kelly movies, and I always joked around and said, oh, I'd love to be Princess Grace Kelly, you know, but I never thought that that would happen.
Well, and now you've gotten a little bit of a princess vibe from the well, from the way the music world is treating you. I have had, you know, real old hands who have been around quite a bit running jazz clubs and, you know, playing on the scene saying, you have got to hear Grace Kelly, and then I finally did hear you in a concert. You've brought your saxophone, as we said. Let's just hear a little so that other people can hear what the musicians are hearing. What would you like to play for us?
Well, I could play one of my tunes, Philosophical Flying Fish.
Let's hear a little taste. A little taste, okay. Yeah. Grace Kelly playing her Philosophical Flying Fish. Did you listen to jazz when you were a kid? You were 15 now.
Yeah, no, you know, when I was really young, I wanted to become a Broadway singer because we grew up with the American Songbook songs of my sister, and I would sing duets. And then I fell in love with jazz because my mom, you know, played some jazz on the radio, but it was really the tenor saxophonist Dan Getz. Something about his sound was like the quintessential saxophone sound to me.
And then went to alto sax.
Well, I didn't start with tenor because they usually start you on alto and then, you know, because it's just easier to hold. And when I first started, I couldn't hold the saxophone. So I sat on my case and put a pillow and then put the saxophone on the pillow and played. And it's really funny because I've watched some video footage of when I first started and it's just a hilarious sight.
Because it's too big, right?
Yeah.
You couldn't get higher than it.
Right. I was 10, so that's how I played.
Well, and as you said, you play, writing your own music. Listen to a little of your song, Every Road I Walked. It's the title track from your last CD. It won the Young Jazz Composer Award. Let's listen. Also arranged this song for the Boston Pops.
I did, yes. I had the pleasure and honor of playing with the Boston Pops, led by the great Keith Lockhart, last June. Keith asked me what I'd like to do, and I said, well, I don't know if this would be possible, but I'd love to arrange one of my tunes for the orchestra. Now, I don't know what I was thinking, because I'd never done that before, but the idea just popped into my head, because they said, we'd love to play a tune of yours.
Ah, youth.
I was just crazy. Well, whatever. And I started writing, and I don't know how I did it, but I learned all about the string instruments and then everything, and I wrote for the orchestra and gave it to Keith, and he said, okay, it looks great, let's do it, and we did it.
Ask, I mean, here you are with Keith Lockhart, also played with Phil Woods, as we said. He gave you his cap. Now, Phil Woods' black leather cap is his trademark. He says he's never given one to an alto sax player before.
Yeah, you know, it was really funny because I had met him earlier in this summer, this was two summers ago, at the Stanford Jazz Residency, and then I went to see him at the Pittsfield Jazz Festival. I went backstage and said hi, and he gave me a huge hug, and then he said, do you have your horn with you? I said, well, my horn's always with me, and he said, oh, go get it, let's play a tune together. And so he brought me up on stage, we played I'll Remember April, and after my solo, he gave his hat and put it on my head, and, you know, it was just a nice gesture, and after his solo, I tried to give it back to him. And he said, no, no, keep it, looks good on you. And now he's a shiny new one.
And his is on your head all the time.
It is, it is. Whenever I play around and, you know, I just think it gives a good omen.
Oh, sure. Well, let's go back to your singing. On your last CD, Every Road I Walked, you covered the Lennon McCartney song, I Will. I mean, it didn't give you pause. The Beatles, you know.
I love the Beatles, and I love their music so much. And, you know, I just thought it would be special to cover something of theirs. And this was a beautiful little tune, so I kind of did my arrangement and changed it up.
Who knows how long I've loved you? You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I will.
You know, I almost feel badly speaking about your age as much as we have, because it's radio, and just listening to your music, a lot of people wouldn't even know how old you are. You have such a mature sound. But given that you're 15, do you ever feel like, oh, I'm so tired of this? Or, you know, God, is it like piano lessons are for some kids? Or is this the life?
Oh, no. If anything, this is the most exciting thing that's happening to me. I mean, I feel so blessed to have met so many people and get so many opportunities. And sometimes I just think to myself about all the things that have come around, and I'm just thinking, well, if you only live once, like, why not have fun? And this is just like, I'm just having fun.
That's Grace Kelly performing Happy Theme Song in our studios last year. It's on her new CD, Mood Changes. For more information, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now. Thank you.